On Ideas, the 1988 Massey Lectures, about media, propaganda, and democracy. A series of five talks, one each night this week, divided into 16 sections, including questions from a panel of distinguished Canadian journalists. The Massey Lectures have been an annual event on CBC Radio for the past 27 years. The Massey Lectures are commissioned by the CBC to present original work by prominent intellectuals in the social sciences and the humanities, the physical sciences, and literature. The 1988 Massey Lectures are given by Noam Chomsky, Institute Professor in the Department of Linguistics and Philosophy at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Boston. Professor Chomsky's work in structural linguistics is world-renowned, and he's also well-known for his controversial books of political criticism, focusing especially on the place of the United States in international affairs. Last month, Pantheon published his latest book, written with co-author Edward Herman. It's called Manufacturing Consent. Professor Chomsky says that a primary function of the mass media, a system he suggests is more properly called the elite media, is to mobilize public support for the special interests that dominate the government and the private sector. This view is in contrast to the common assumption that the media act independently of power elites and are committed to discovering and reporting the truth. Professor Chomsky has demonstrated, by assembling a mass of data from the mainstream print and electronic press, that the common assumption is wrong, that the mass media in fact constitute a propaganda system devoted to conveying what Reinhold Niebuhr called necessary illusions about the world, devised by the intellectual elites. Without these necessary illusions, there's a danger that democracy will function altogether too well, that there will be, in the words of the Trilateral Commission, a crisis of democracy that will threaten elite power and privilege. One way to see how the mass media function to support the necessary illusions required by government and business elites is to compare style and content of news reports where the actions of official friends and official enemies are concerned. Professor Chomsky does that tonight, examining the treatment of Israel, an official friend of the United States, and Nicaragua, an official enemy, in the U.S. media, which is also our main source of information about international affairs. The 1988 Massey Lectures, Part 8. Noam Chomsky.
Fabrication of necessary illusions for social management is as old as history. But in the democratic system, the necessary illusions cannot be imposed by force. Rather, they must be instilled in the public mind by more subtle means. A totalitarian state can be satisfied with lesser degrees of allegiance to required truths. It is sufficient that people obey. What they think is a secondary concern. But in a democratic political order, there's always the danger that an independent thought might be translated into political action. So it is important to eliminate the threat at its root. Debate cannot be stilled, and indeed it should not be stilled in a properly functioning system of propaganda. The reason is that it has a system-reinforcing character if it is constrained within proper bounds. What is essential is to set the bounds firmly. Controversy may rage as long as it adheres to the presuppositions that define the elite consensus. And it should furthermore be encouraged within these bounds. That helps to establish these doctrines as the very condition of thinkable thought, and it reinforces the belief that freedom reigns. One crucial doctrine, standard throughout history, is that the state is adopting a defensive stance, resisting challenges to order and to its noble principles. Thus, the United States is invariably resisting aggression, sometimes what's called internal aggression. Accordingly, it's a logical impossibility that anyone should oppose U.S. aggression. That's a category that cannot exist. Westerners have no problem in perceiving the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan as brutal aggression. But the U.S. invasion of South Vietnam in the early 1960s cannot be perceived as such. True, U.S. forces were directly engaged in large-scale bombing and defoliation in an effort to drive the population into concentration camps where they could be, as we put it, protected from the enemy whom it was conceded they willingly support. True, a huge U.S. expeditionary force invaded and ravaged the country and later its neighbors with the explicit aim of destroying what was clearly recognized to be the only mass-based political force and eliminating the danger of political settlement that was sought on all sides. But throughout, we were resisting aggression and our yearning for democracy. Throughout the war, there was no departure in the mainstream from the doctrine that the United States was defending South Vietnam. Unwisely, the doves came to believe. Years later, the doctrine remains beyond challenge, a most remarkable demonstration of the effectiveness of democratic systems of thought control. Similarly, in the case of Central America today, the United States is defending freedom in what are called the fledgling democracies and restoring democracy to Nicaragua. We find this view even at the extreme of expressible dissent in the elite media. In a bitter condemnation of the U.S. attack on Nicaragua, Atlantic Monthly editor Jack Beatty writes that democracy has been our goal in Nicaragua, and to reach it, we have sponsored the killing of thousands of Nicaraguans. One could hardly find a more consistent critic of U.S. policy in the corporate media than columnist Tom Wicker of the New York Times. He condemns the application of the Reagan Doctrine to Nicaragua because, in his words, the United States has no historic or God-given right to bring democracy to other nations. Critics assume, without a second thought, that a yearning for democracy has indeed guided U.S. policy towards Nicaragua since July 1979, when our client Somoza was overthrown, though, admittedly, we were not guided by this policy before the miraculously and curiously timed transformation took place. Central America has an evident interest in hounding the Sandinistas to honor their pledges to democratize, so the editors of the Washington Post admonish. There's no problem of ensuring democracy in the U.S.-backed terror states of Central America, firmly under military rule, behind a thin civilian facade. The same editorial in the Washington Post warns that from the incursions into Honduras in March 1988, it is plain what Nicaragua's threats to Honduras are. The references to military operations in northern Nicaragua, in which Nicaraguan forces, in hot pursuit of contra invaders, penetrated a few kilometers into areas of Honduras that had long been ceded to the Contras. In the United States, these actions elicited renewed outrage over the threat of the Sandinistas to overrun their neighbors in the interests of their Soviet master. This heartfelt concern over the sanctity of borders is perhaps somewhat tainted by the curious conception of a border as a kind of a one-way mirror. So the sanctity of a border is not violated by U.S. supply flights to its proxy forces who have entered Nicaragua from their Honduran bases. But putting aside these matters, we can assess the seriousness of the concern by turning to the results of a controlled experiment that history obligingly constructed. Just as the free press was consumed with rage over this latest proof of the aggressiveness of the violent communist totalitarians in Central America, with major stories and angry commentary, our client State of Israel launched another series of its periodic operations in Lebanon. These operations were north of the sector of southern Lebanon that Israel has virtually annexed as a security zone, integrating the area with Israel's economy and compelling its 200,000 Lebanese inhabitants to provide soldiers for the South Lebanese Army, an Israeli mercenary force, as the Israeli press observes. The Israeli operations included bombing of Palestinian refugee camps and Lebanese towns and villages with large-scale destruction, dozens of people killed and many wounded, including many civilians. All of this was barely reported, and there was no noticeable reaction. The only rational conclusion is that the media outrage over the far less serious and more justified Nicaraguan incursion was entirely unprincipled, mere fraud. The absence of comment or even serious reporting of the Israeli actions in Lebanon is perhaps understandable. These operations were, after all, rather muted by Israeli standards. They do not compare with the murderous Iron Fist operations in Lebanon in 1985, or the bombing of villages in the Bekaa Valley a year earlier, with 100 killed and 400 wounded, mostly civilians, including 150 children in a bombed-out schoolhouse in one raid. These were reported, but without affecting the elevated status of Israel. This tiny nation, symbol of human decency, as the editors of the New York Times described it, just at the height of the repression of the current Palestinian uprising, with beatings, killings, gassing, and collective punishment. It is a country that cares for human life, in the admiring words of the Washington Post editors, in the wake of the Iron Fist atrocities. The fact that Israel maintains a security zone in southern Lebanon, controlled by a terrorist mercenary army backed by Israeli might, also passes without notice. And the same is true of Israel's regular practice of hijacking and piracy in international waters, and other actions that are rarely even reported. If Soviet Jews were to suffer the treatment meted out regularly to Arabs, or if some official enemy, such as Nicaragua, were to impose repressive measures approaching the Israeli standard, the outcry would be deafening. During Israel's March 1988 operations in Lebanon, there was no issue of hot pursuit. Israel is not an impoverished country, attempting to survive the terrorist attack of a superpower and its lethal economic warfare. But Israel is a U.S. client, and therefore it inherits the right of aggression. Nicaragua, in contrast, is denied the right even to drive attacking forces out of its own territory. This is on the tacit assumption that no state has the right to defend itself from U.S. attack, another crucial doctrine that underlies responsible debate. It's remarkable to see how deeply this doctrine is entrenched. To cite one striking example, nothing arouses greater hysteria in the United States than reports that Nicaragua is planning to obtain MiG fighters. When such reports were floated by the Reaganites to eliminate the danger of honest reporting of the Nicaraguan elections in November 1984, even outspoken doves warned that the United States would have to bomb Nicaragua to destroy the invented MiGs. The reason is that they're also capable against the United States, a dire threat to our security, as Massachusetts Senator Paul Tsongas, a noted dove, put it at the time. In another propaganda coup of December 1987, a Sandinista defector was presented with elaborate accompanying fanfare in the media. He produced a series of revelations about Sandinista intentions, the most stunning of which was that Nicaragua was hoping to obtain jet planes to defend its territory from U.S. attack, plainly an intolerable outrage. It is, of course, well understood that Nicaragua had no other way to prevent the CIA from supplying the forces it directs within Nicaragua or to interfere with the surveillance flights by U.S. aircraft that provide these forces with up-to-the-minute intelligence on Nicaraguan troop deployments so that they can safely attack soft targets in accordance with Pentagon and State Department directives. The logic is clear. Nicaragua has no right of self-defense. It is intolerable, tantamount to aggression, for Nicaragua to interfere with U.S. violence and terror by attempting to defend its airspace or by attacking the U.S. proxy forces. For the same reason, the report by the same defector that Nicaragua intended to reduce its military forces while providing light arms to the population for defense against possible U.S. invasion elicited further outrage as it was transmuted by the free press into a threat to conquer the hemisphere. One might ask why Nicaragua is so intent on obtaining Soviet planes. Why not French Mirage jets instead? In fact, the Sandinistas would be quite happy to obtain jet interceptors from France and quite openly say so. They cannot, because U.S. pressure has blocked supply from any non-communist source. All of this is unreportable because it would give the game away. A corollary to the principle that official enemies do not have the right of self-defense is that if Nicaragua attacks contra forces within its own territory, the United States plainly has the right to provide military aid to its proxies. the Byrd Amendment on assistance for the Nicaraguan resistance, voted by the Senate in August 1988, with the effusive support of leading doves, permits military aid to the proxy forces within Nicaragua in the event of an unprovoked attack against the Contras or a continued unacceptable level of military assistance by Soviet bloc countries, all other sources having been barred, and Washington, of course, being the judge of what is acceptable. The August 5th Senate debate on the Byrd Amendment gains heightened significance from its timing. 3 days earlier, the Contras had attacked the crowded passenger vessel Mission of Peace after allowing an army patrol boat to pass by. They had killed 2 people and wounded 27, all civilians, including a Baptist minister from New Jersey, a member of a U.S. religious delegation. The Senate doves, who bitterly condemned the Sandinistas, made no mention of this event. Perhaps they had missed the tiny notice it received the day before in the New York Times, tacked on to a column reporting their deliberations. There was no subsequent commentary. The logic is again clear. If the Sandinistas seek to root out the U.S.-run terrorists who carried out this atrocity, that proves that they are communist totalitarians, and we are entitled to send military as well as so-called humanitarian aid to the resistance so that they can pursue their tasks more effectively. The general outlines of U.S. policy are presented in a lucid manner by a Carter administration Latin American specialist, Robert Pastor, who is actually at the dovish extreme of the political and ideological spectrum. He explains that the United States, I'm quoting, that the United States did not want to control Nicaragua or other nations in the region, but it also did not want to allow developments to get out of control. It wanted Nicaraguans to act independently, except when doing so would affect U.S. interests adversely. In short, Nicaragua should be free to do what we determine to be right and proper, and Nicaragua should achieve self-determination in the manner that the United States defines as appropriate.
On Ideas, you're listening to the 1988 Massey Lectures by Noam Chomsky. Part 9, The Bounds of the Expressible.
In the first lecture, I mentioned some of the ways of approaching the study of the media and evaluating models of media performance. One appropriate method is to consider the spectrum of opinion that is allowed expression. According to the propaganda model, one would expect the spectrum to be bounded by the elite consensus while encouraging tactical debate within it. Consider U.S. policy with regard to Nicaragua. That's probably elicited more controversy and impassioned rhetoric than any other single topic during the past several years. There is debate between the hawks on the one side and the doves on the other. The position of the hawks is expressed by a declaration of the State and Defense Departments on International Human Rights Day in December 1986. They asserted that in the American continent, there is no regime more barbaric and bloody, no regime that violates human rights in a manner more constant and permanent than the Sandinista regime. Similar sentiments are widely voiced in the media and the political system, and it follows that we should support the democratic resistance to communist terror. At the other extreme, the doves generally agree that we should dismiss the World Court, the United Nations, and other hostile forums, as they're called, that pander to communists and pathological third-world anti-Americanism. The doves offer their support for the noble objective of the Reagan administration to somehow democratize Nicaragua, but they feel that the Contras are not the instrument that will achieve that objective. I've been quoting Representative Michael Barnes, who was one of the most outspoken critics of the Contra option. A leading Senate dove, Alan Cranston, recognizes that the Contra effort is woefully inadequate to achieve democracy in Nicaragua, in his words, so we should find other means to isolate the reprehensible government in Managua and leave it to fester in its own juices. Media doves observe that Mr. Reagan's policy of supporting the Contras is a clear failure, so we should acquiesce in some negotiated regional settlement that would be enforced by Nicaragua's neighbors. That's Tom Wicker of the New York Times. Expressing the same thought, the editors of the Washington Post see the Contras as an imperfect instrument, so we must find other means to fit Nicaragua back into a Central American mode and impose reasonable conduct by a regional standard. Other doves feel that we should not too quickly reject the State Department argument that agricultural cooperatives are legitimate targets for Contra attacks. The reason, I'm quoting, is that in a Marxist society geared for war, there are no clear lines separating officials, soldiers, and civilians. What is required is careful cost-benefit analysis, a determination of the amount of blood and misery that will be poured in, and the likelihood that democracy will emerge at the other end. Those are the words of New Republic editor Michael Kinsley. Neither he nor the State Department explain why similar arguments do not justify attacks by Abu Nidal on Israeli kibbutzim, which are far better defended against an incomparably lesser threat. Notice that regional arrangements need not be imposed on our Salvadoran and Guatemalan friends, who have slaughtered perhaps 150,000 people during this period, or on our clients in Honduras, who kill fewer outright, but have left hundreds of thousands to starve to death while the country exports food for the profit of agribusiness. Their countries already conform to the Central American mode of repression, exploitation, and rule by privileged elements that accede to the demands of U.S. power, what we call democracy, so even hideous atrocities are of no account. And they merit aid and support, with occasional expressions of regret if the terror, torture, and mutilation become too visible to ignore. By 1986, the Contra option was opposed by 80% of American leaders, polls report. The propaganda model would therefore predict debate over Contra aid, but near unanimity in opposition to the Sandinistas. To test the hypothesis, consider the period of maximum intensity of debate over Nicaragua policy, the first 3 months of 1986, when attention was focused on the issue of Contra aid. During these months, the New York Times and the Washington Post, the two major national newspapers, they ran no less than 85 opinion columns on the matter. That includes their regular columnists. As expected, they were divided over Contra aid. But of the 85 columns, all 85 were critical of the Sandinistas, the vast majority harshly so. Thus, 100% conformity was achieved on the major issue. It's not that more sympathetic voices are lacking in the mainstream. There are many who would easily qualify for admission to the debate if they had the right things to say. This includes Latin American scholars whose opinion pieces are regularly rejected by the press, or the charitable development agency Oxfam, with long experience in the region, which found Nicaragua's record to be exceptional among the 76 developing countries in which it works, in the commitment of the political leadership to improving the condition of the people and encouraging their active participation in the development process. I'm quoting here an Oxfam report. Or consider the founder of Costa Rican democracy, José Figueres. Just at the time we're speaking of, early 1986, he had described himself in an interview as pro-Sandinista and quite friendly toward the Sandinistas. He was an observer in the 1984 elections, and he said that the 2-1 margin in favor of the Sandinistas in these elections certainly seemed to reflect what you find in the streets. Figueres condemned what he called Washington's incredible policies of persecuting the Sandinistas and Washington's efforts to undo Costa Rica's social institutions and to turn the whole economy over to the local oligarchy or to U.S. or European companies. Of course, as a dedicated supporter of the United States, he found these efforts, in his words, no doubt well-intentioned. The United States, he said, is turning most Central Americans into mercenaries for its attack against Nicaragua. I've been familiar with Nicaragua all my life, he said, and never before have I seen, as I do now, a Nicaraguan government that cares for its people. In another interview at the same time, he reiterated that for the first time, Nicaragua has a government that cares for its people, his words. Commenting on a recent visit, he said that he found a surprising amount of support for the government in what he called an invaded country, adding that the United States should allow the Sandinistas to finish what they started in peace. They deserve it. Such comments as these lack ideological serviceability. The same is true of Figueres' statement that he understands why La Prensa was closed, having censored the press himself when Costa Rica was under attack by Somoza in the 1950s. Hence, Central America's leading democratic figure must be censored out of the media, as he is, though his name can still be invoked for the anti-Sandinista crusade. Thus, New York Times Central America correspondent James Lemoyne, in one of his anti-Sandinista diatribes, refers to Figueres as the man who is widely considered the father of Costa Rican democracy. But he does not tell us, nor would he or his colleagues ever tell us, what Figueres has to say about the Sandinistas. The front pages of the New York Times present a picture of Nicaragua as seen through the eyes of their reporter James Lemoyne as he briefly passed through. A brutal and repressive state under one-party rule, with crowds of pot-bellied urchins in the streets, state security agents ubiquitous, the army everywhere, growing support for the peasant army resisting Sandinista oppression, and the population reduced to bitterness and apathy. That's his description, though somehow they are resisting a foreign attack under which any other state in the region and most elsewhere would have quickly crumbled. The New York Times does not present the picture that was seen by the CIA-appointed press spokesman for the Contras, Edgar Chamorro, on a three-week visit at the same time. Speaking to dozens of people in the streets after a Sandinista rally, he found them, in his words, very aware, very politically educated, very committed. They thought for themselves. They were there because they wanted to be there. The days are gone when a dictator can get up and harangue people. What I have seen here, he said, is very, very positive. People are walking on their own two feet, regaining the dignity and nationalism that they had lost under Somoza. He saw very little militarization and a deep sense of equality, what he called one of the accomplishments of the revolution. I didn't see people hungry, he said. Most people look very healthy, strong, and alive. And he saw few beggars, unlike Honduras, or even in the city streets of the United States, he added. The opposition he described as the old oligarchy reliant on the United States. The war has led to a sense of nationalism and patriotism on the part of the youth who are drafted. The Sandinistas continue to be a people's party with commitment and goals that inspire so many people. They are Nicaraguan nationalists, revolutionaries, who want a more egalitarian model to improve the lives of the majority. The elections were good, the government is legitimate, and we should try to change from inside. I've just been quoting Chamorro's actual words from an interview that appeared in a tiny and obscure journal, and Chamorro himself points out that after he left the Contras, he found media access difficult, although when he was the spokesman, it was quite simple. The general reading public does not receive a range of perceptions such as these, but only one, the one that accords with the needs of American power.